The views and opinions expressed by A Little Bit Culty are those of the hosts and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the podcast. Any content provided by our guests, bloggers, sponsors, or authors are of their opinion and are not intended to malign any religion, group, club, organization, business, individual, anyone, or anything. Welcome to A Little Bit Culty, a podcast about what happens when something that seems like a great thing at first goes to the dark side and takes you with it. I'm your host, Sarah Edmondson.
And I'm also your host, Anthony Ames, a.k.a. Nippy. Sarah and I met, fell in love in a, quote, self-help organization that turned out to be a mega cult called Nexium. Heard of it? We got out of there together, and on our way out, we helped shut it down. Our journey as Nexium whistleblowers was captured in detail on a docuseries called The Vow on HBO, and also on the front page of a newspaper.
New York Times, babe.
Right.
Have you heard of it? Each week on A Little Bit Culty, we talk with other former cult members and whistleblowers, plus experts in things like cultic abuse and coercive control.
We also turn the mic over to advocates and clinicians with wisdom to share on recovering from everything from MLMs and toxic religion to bad romances with raging narcissists.
There's always something to learn about the cultiverse. Be sure to subscribe to A Little Bit Culty so you don't miss an episode. Find us on Instagram and at alittlebitculty.com.
Well, 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 Miss Edmondson.
Look what we have here.
Look at what we have here.
It's been a good week.
It has. It has been a good week. We've had some fun.
Had our 9-year anniversary.
Yeah. We got to see Whitney Cummings backstage.
Live in person.
Yeah,
oh,
that was fun.
Wow. What a great show. And also, you know, almost coming up on 3 years that we met on the social media after The Vow came out, and we've been social media friends. And to be real,
no, it'd be two. That was October of 20, right after he got sentenced.
I can do math.
So it's almost 2 years. Basic math.
Basic math. Oh, never mind. In almost 2 years, The Vow will have come out. In answer to some of your questions, no, we do not know when season two is coming out. Hopefully soon.
No. They will not tell us, but we do know that we're not in it that much, which I'm kind of happy about, to be honest with you. Aren't you?
I mean, I don't need to be in it. There's so much more to the story in the inner circle stuff and the follow-up with the trial. That's nothing really to do with us.
We can't help you there.
Can't help you there.
We can't help you there. Yeah, that's not our story.
As soon as we know and are allowed to share, I promise you, our audience, will be the third to know. I'll probably tell my parents.
Who knows, man?
Anyway, guys, we've had lots of fun since the Ask Me Anything last week. Again, thank you for your questions. We'll do another one of those soon. Thank you also to everyone who's been donating and following us on TikTok. I still only have one personal video posted, but just give me some time. But also, many of you have asked how else you can support, and truly, reviews. There's been some really beautiful reviews, some kind of funny, terrible reviews, but
some of them, like, you know, I'm all about the insults.
Who's the one who said that you're asleep at the wheel or something? And they called you Nipple?
No, they said, yeah, drop the nipple. He sounds like he's half asleep.
I love that. So keep those reviews going. And
that's great. Not like that. You know, I mean, oh, by the way, just because, you know, my name's Nippy and you came up with Nipple, it's not original.
Right.
It's not at all.
We've been hearing that since
fifth grade. It's fifth grade humor. Pretty sure you can do better. That was not a natural segue, but I'll let you segue into our guest intro.
I cannot think of a segue into this other than to say.
Okay, then I'll do it.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, only to say that our guest that we're excited about.
Yeah, of course. She's great. And she's got a mind on her.
Yeah, and she's so articulate.
Super smart. Articulates it in, I think, more compassionate ways than I've heard. So enjoy.
I'm going to preface it by saying that this is an interview with someone who left the modern Orthodox community, Orthodox Judaism. And just to preface to say, like, this episode is not so much like what are the culty aspects of that particular community in Judaism. It's more about leaving. And for those who aren't super well-versed in the different communities, there's such a diverse range in the whole spectrum from like extreme left to right. And there's, you know, modern Orthodoxy and there's secular Judaism, Reform Judaism, and people who consider themselves culturally Jewish, like myself. And then there's, you know, Hasidic and, you know, right-wing, very extreme groups. and everything in between. So this is just about one particular community.
The same thing that happens in our political spectrum happens in the religion spectrum. You just have extremes of each.
Yeah, and same with Christianity
too,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so our guest today, Tova Mervis, is the author of three novels, Visible City, Outside World, and Ladies Auxiliary, which was a national bestseller. Her essays have appeared in various anthologies and newspapers, including the New York Times Book Review, the Boston Globe Magazine, Commentary, Good Housekeeping, and Poets and Writers, and her fiction has been broadcast on NPR.
In her fiction, Tova frequently depicts characters who are living in Orthodox Jewish communities and struggling with their faith.
But in 2017, she turned the page from fiction to memoir, publishing The Book of Separation, which is a searing look at her divorce, her exit from the Orthodox community, and her experience navigating single motherhood.
She joined us to talk about The Book of Separation, her latest book, and her spiritual journey.
We love this book. Highly recommend it.
Enjoy our conversation with Tova Mervis.
Tova, it's so good to see your face and to meet you finally.
It's great to be here. It's such a pleasure to talk to you.
Nice to meet you, Tova.
Hello.
Just right off the top, I have to say that I just loved your book. I was also very, Nippy can attest, I was like a puddle of tears on the floor a few minutes ago, just like so emotional about your journey and what you've gone through and your willingness to share that with people, even with the backdrop of this very, and this is just my own projection, but like rigid and extreme religion that you grew up in, how scary that must be. I'm guessing to like put yourself out there in such a real vulnerable and like counter to that whole backdrop with your family still so immersed. So yeah, I have a great respect for what you've done. And I'm wondering if you wouldn't mind for our audience, share with us a little bit about what that backdrop was for you. And I also just wanted to say for the purpose of this podcast, I'm less inclined to focus on like the nitty gritty of ultra Orthodox Judaism and what was problematic about it. Although I do want to talk about that, but my goal for this podcast would be to use your journey as a template for anyone questioning and getting out of anything and healing from anything, because I think you're so articulate about how to do that.
Thank you.
Just throwing that out there.
And you know what I love, Sarah, about your book, and what I love about so many memoirs that tell the story of leaving a world or leaving a family or literally leaving anything, is that the particulars vary so much. We have different lives we're part of. We leave different things for different reasons. But memoir writing is really about this idea that in each of our very particular experiences, there are these universal truths. So my world doesn't have to match up to your world. I don't have to say, oh, this is the same or different. But what is so in common between them is the sense that leaving something and leaving behind the person you imagine yourself to be or the community you create for yourself and the identity that that creates, it's so enormously painful to leave something, even when you need to leave it or you want to leave it for so many reasons. And that sense of crafting a separation from a part of your own self really requires this recreating of who you are. And you know, I think so much about the idea of separations. And if I'm terrible with book titles, every book I've written, the title is always the final thing, like at that very last second where I'm like, why don't we call it No Title by Tova Mervis? But this book, I knew from the very start that it had to be called The Book of Separation, because I felt like it's about the multiple kinds of separations we make. And, you know, for me as a writer, I wrote two novels about the Orthodox Jewish world that I was part of. I wrote a third novel. And I love writing fiction because you get to make up worlds and you get to imagine your way into other people's lives and really to ask the question of, you know, what does it feel like to be someone else? What does it feel like not to be me, but to be someone else? But with writing this book, I knew that I couldn't fictionalize this experience. I knew that it had to be a book about what does it mean to really lay claim to your own story, to say that this is my own questions and my own struggles and my own choice to become someone different than who I was supposed to be. And, you know, as you said, like writing memoir, I'm sure you know this from your book and from the podcast, you know, anytime you put out your honest, true story, it's so scary. It makes you incredibly vulnerable. And for me, writing the memoir really started with an essay I wrote. I wrote an essay about my Orthodox Jewish divorce ceremony, in which I came to realize I was leaving not just a marriage, but the religious world that had shaped me. And I ended up sending it to the New York Times on something of a crazy moment of like, oh, that'll be fine. What, you know, I'm sure they won't take it. What harm could come in mailing it, you know, emailing it to them? And they wrote back saying they wanted to publish it. And I was terrified because you make yourself so vulnerable when you put your story out in the world. And when that essay did come out, I was shocked. I got hundreds and hundreds of emails from people of all religious worlds and all backgrounds who had left something. People wrote about divorce and about leaving families and leaving Mormonism and Catholicism, just really any religious world that you could name. And I came to this realization really as a writer that when you make yourself vulnerable, when you are willing to put that private, painful story out into the public eye, it enables other people to share their stories and to tell them. And that sense of, yes, it's totally different. My world is so different from yours, but I too feel this. I also have had this kind of experience.
Well, it's the nature of the pursuit of truth. And Sarah and I had some mentors, like with Mike Rinder and Leah Remini. We kind of followed their model. And that's one of the most impressive things. And you touched on it earlier about the pursuit of truth. In your situation in particular, you know, Sarah and I were talking about it. It's like, how did you know? Like, you grow up in it, you don't really have context per se for anything else. Speak about how that, you know, when religions offer a truth, or the pursuit of truth, and you think it's your truth, how do you know that it's not? And what's that process like for you?
I grew up in a modern Orthodox Jewish community in Memphis, Tennessee. Memphis is not really what people think of as like a stronghold right. of Orthodox Judaism, but
I had sure. no idea that community sure. even existed.
Most so. People do yeah. not. I'm a sixth generation Memphian. So, you know, my family has been there for a long time, and there is an Orthodox wow. community there. And we're part of a modern Orthodox community, which means that, you know, there's a wide range of practices within Judaism that really run the gamut. And even within Orthodox Judaism, one branch of Judaism, there's a wide range of practice. And so we were, you know, just as a large generalization, modern Orthodoxy differs from ultra-Orthodoxy in terms of its relationship to the outside world, how closed off it is from secular society, secular education, and secular cultures. So modern Orthodoxy kind of has as its idea that you can belong to the secular world, you go to college, watch TV, go to movies, but yet still hold on to strict religious belief. And somehow you synthesize these two ideals. And sometimes they contradict and sometimes they don't, but you somehow work them into some seemingly cohesive whole. And so I grew up in a very small world. I went to a very small Jewish school in Memphis where there were 10 kids in my class, 10, 15 kids over the years. And really my entire world was the Orthodox community. It was everyone I knew. My entire family, more or less, was Orthodox. And I think like any child born into any world, you assume that is the world. That was the boundaries of my world was this community and my family. And I felt very much this sense of very much an awareness that to follow the rules was to be good, and that to be good was to be loved, that in order to be inside this world, this is what you did. This is just what the world looked like. And certainly as a child, I just accepted the world as it was. I was trained very well to be a good girl. I was never a rebel. I was a rule follower. I wanted to please and wanted to belong into the world that I was born in. I have a loving family. I'm very close to them. I had no sense that I wanted to be anything other than the person I was being raised to be. In high school, I did chafe a little bit. I was too timid to actually do anything about it except think inside my head and be annoyed. But there's a lot of focus on dress codes and the role of girls and role of women and what girls can do and can't do as opposed to boys in terms of ritual participation. My skirt length seemed to be the be all and end all of my religious belonging, whether my skirt was an inch below my knee or a bunch above my knee. And we, you know, used to wear skirts that we could pull up or down depending on who's looking. But most of all, I had that sense that this is what it meant to be a good girl, that to follow the rules, to stay inside this world really at all cost. And I knew about people who were no longer Orthodox. I had a second cousin who wasn't Orthodox. It was sort of like, you know, oh, you know, we don't talk about her exactly. You know, she was sort of there, but I don't think I maybe knew who she was, but it was just the sense that you were other. You were far outside the confines of that world. And I guess the real test case for that community comes with college, where many kids go to Orthodox colleges, but a large number go to secular colleges as well, which is what I did. But there was so much the sense that, you know, hold on to what you have. Don't lose your belief. Don't be led astray. Don't go off the path. You know, the term for someone like me is you're off the derech, which means in English, off the path. There's a path, there's one path, and if you step off of it, you get lost. And just that feeling that to think differently or to want something else or to question a belief and ultimately to reject a belief system was to find yourself outside that world, to be lost.
Just to backtrack for a sec, as you probably know from our pod now that we ask, how did people get in?
Right.
A lot of our guests are joining something in life, like we join Nexium as young adults, but you were born into it. So then the question that I'd love to know is was it your grandmother who decided to become Orthodox, if I'm remembering correctly? And I'm curious about this also, because as you know, I was raised what I called half and half, which obviously wasn't a real thing for an Orthodox person. My mom is
Jewish.
Yes, exactly.
My mom being secular Jewish and my dad being ex-Anglican atheist celebrating Christmas, I had this sort of mishmash of things, but I'm looking at your world that you were in, and I'm wondering when your grandmother chose that, what was your family vision in terms of like, what was the goal? What was being promised? Like, if you follow these rules and you do X, Y, and Z, what do you get? And what's the promise of those choices?
I think there's like the pull that so many religious communities of all kinds offer, this feeling, I think most of all, of belonging. I think community lies at the heart of so much. And I think just thinking about some of the things you've talked about in your own experiences, that urge to belong to something, to feel this connection. I mean, I think it's one of the most basic human urges to feel connected mm-hmm. to a whole and to feel, I think, also a sense of certainty about the world, to feel like the world is a complicated, terrifying, really hard place. But if I situate myself inside this world, that I get to hold truth in my hands. I mean, what an amazing idea, right? I get to have the truth and I get to be good and I get to do what God wants me to do. I mean, I'm being told, do this thing and then you are good. I mean, it's appealing. Even now, I feel the tug. I don't believe it, but I feel the tug, that sense that the world becomes manageable and ordered. It becomes explainable. You have a system for understanding the horrors around us. And so, you know, both of my grandmothers were part of, I guess, traditional Jewish families. They both became Orthodox, really to get married. It's funny how much the stories parallel each other, very different contexts between both of them, but they both married someone who was Orthodox. You know, especially with my grandmother who died when I was 15, I would love to have a conversation with her now as an adult to understand her own mindset. But I think it was a very different world. My one grandmother was 18, my other grandmother was close to 30, which was, you know, very old to be unmarried. And that sense that this was a world being handed to them. I don't think that they, as far as I know, I don't think they struggled with what it meant to be part of that world. Although I wish I knew. I wish I knew more about that. My novelist mind wants to create stories and imagine it.
Maybe another book there.
One day.
Yeah, this is the world. And we'll go back to some of that. And obviously, we're going to tell our listeners that this is an incredible book to read. And I think everyone will find it useful and emotional and healing. I also love how you, as you were laying out your journey with this choice to leave, to separate, that you also wove in the sort of the meaning behind a lot of the Jewish traditions and rituals and holidays, to the point where I learned, I learned more about what the meaning was behind certain symbolic things that I think many people know about, but don't know why we, you know, smash the glass when people are getting married or circle the chuppah at a wedding ceremony seven times. Like, what's the meaning behind that? Which I found really meaningful. And I also loved how you led us through your slow wake up. And that's one of our questions always is like, what, we wouldn't necessarily call them red flags in this case, but what were the moments? And I think there's some that started in childhood where you're like, that doesn't actually resonate for me. And you start to question things at quite a young age. Can you take us back to some of those moments in the book or life, your life?
Sure. I know. It's funny. I'm like, in the book, I'm like, wait, that's me. Yeah. I guess I don't think about it as waking up. I think about it as starting to listen to my own inner feeling of doubt. And, you know, when I look back at being in high school, it was that quiet little voice that said, really? Do I really think this? Do I really believe it? And maybe it was the person in me who would learn about dress code and how important it was for me to dress a certain way and about modesty and about accepting that girls could not play a public role in synagogue life, or being told that girls were exempt from many of the commandments because girls were naturally more holy. We were closer to God. You know, there were a series of apologetics that we were told. And I remember so clearly sitting in these classrooms trying to pull that jean skirt just a tiny bit lower so I wouldn't get in trouble. And just thinking, I don't think that makes sense. I mean, that doesn't ring true to me in that deep, satisfying way. But yet at the same time, having to do this sort of internal mental gymnastics to make it make sense, because I knew there was the equation. It couldn't be sexist. It couldn't be. It seemed like it was. So what could I do to it so that it wasn't? And that feeling would come up a lot, that feeling of needing to make something be okay, because, you know, if it wasn't okay, what did that mean for me? What did it mean to feel that I lived my whole life based on something, but I didn't really believe it was true? I mean, that felt like a terrifying, you know, situation to find myself in. As I went to college, I went to Columbia, where I could have been anyone or studied anything, but I was so focused in college on not learning anything or experiencing anything or exposing myself to anything that might have challenged what I already believed. I did not go to college to open my mind. I didn't want to become someone new. I knew that I had to stay who I was. It was the prospect of being someone who left the path. It felt like you know, you fell off the end of the world, like you disappeared, like you would be meaningless and lost. I remember thinking, if I stopped being Orthodox, how would I ever get married? No one else in the world could get married, it seemed to me. Only if you were part of this community could I get married. And that exerted an enormous influence on me not to be lost, to stay who I was. But those voices were there. I think when you're pushing so hard against being exposed to something, you know there's something you don't want to know. I think our minds have a way of kind of poking us or prodding us and saying, like, there's something here you don't want to think about or don't want to look about. And I solved the problem by getting married very young. I got engaged the middle of my senior year in college to my first boyfriend, who we had dated for 12 weeks. And, you know, it just seemed like, what could go wrong? You know, I was doing what I was supposed to do. I was a good girl. I found a boy who was just like me. Our parents knew each other from years back. And we had the same friends and the same values and community. And before I had known him for a year, we were married. And it just seemed like that was a way to quiet the part of me that was chafing, that part of me that wondered if I was as good of a girl as I pretended to be. I knew that I wanted to be a writer. And so much, I think, of being a fiction writer, any kind of writer, is pushing at those parts that you're not supposed to look at. You know, as a fiction writer, I know, oh, you never look away at the part you're hiding from. That's when you go in. And I think that my religious self could not do that. And so it just lots and lots of these moments of not wanting to look, not wanting to hear that doubt, and continuing to sort of look just away from it, just sort of keep my eyes averted, don't read books that would threaten me. Books, even books about Jewish feminism. I was like, don't go there. That's too threatening. Don't look at that. You know, I don't want to have to rethink anything, because, you know, when your whole life is stacked on top of one belief and you're threatening to pull out that bedrock belief, I think I knew on some level that it would all fall apart if I were to look and to really examine my own lack of belief.
Was there anyone to confide in?
You know, I had friends I talked to about it. I had friends when I was older. I had a very close friend who's also a writer who's Jewish but not Orthodox, and I would talk to her about it. I feel like mostly I wrote about it. My first two novels, when I read them now, I feel like, oh my God, these are all about, like, what did I think? Like, what did I think I was dealing with? They're all about religious doubt, about the complications of belonging to a community. They're about individuality and how that gets stifled in communal living. They are about what happens to the person who quietly doubts but doesn't talk about it. I mean, it's just splayed all over the page, but it was always under the guise of fiction. You know, and fiction is a great place to hide if you don't want it to be you. And so I talked about it that way, I guess. I think I talked about it on the page more than anything else, under the guise of writing about characters.
Did you find a passage that kind of exemplifies that doubt?
Sure.
And while you're pulling it out, I'll just tell our listeners that I feel like the thing that Tova did the best, at least for me as a reader, was to put on paper, or in my case, Audible, your voice, just the inner conflict. Like, I feel like in a way that I wasn't able to in my book, partly because I think I was still processing and still in trauma, but I don't have the writing background that you did, other than like creative writing in grade 10. Like, I didn't have the actual training. And I feel like you so eloquently express through metaphors and imagery, like, what it feels like to be doubting and to question. And so I just, like, so grateful for it as a ex-member of something else who left.
I mean, in some ways, the book is very internal. I mean, there's some action. Plot was never like my strong point. You know, I spent so much time ruminating of like, could I leave? Could I leave? And at some point I was like, okay, right. It's time to do something about all this internal thinking.
Yeah. Well, I loved the internal thinking.
The casualty is your conscience if you don't go towards your truth,
right?
I find.
Right.
You know, one of the things I see in your story is that your conscience wins.
Right.
In all our interviews that we've had similar scenarios of someone who's grown up in it, the most interesting thing to me, bar none, all this is how the people, and that's the human dynamic of all these things, is how you and many others that we've interviewed have this conscience that grows and they can't ignore it. It's so impressive.
Yes.
And the casualty is you if you don't
yourself.
Do it in a lot of ways.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I remember feeling like I could belong to the community. I could be part of this world, but I was estranged from myself then, or that feeling of having this I felt like I had this like secret second self, like this little part of me inside that was always like, really, really? I don't think this at all. Like this inner voice that was there, but it's a hard way to live an entire life.
When you're in, say, in the community, do you diagnose the people that are still in the community as in and not in touch with their conscience? Or do you see that they really believe the tenets, it's consistent? And do you see yourself as more aware than them?
I think there are people who deeply believe, like this question of how do we reconcile the fact that some people believe things that I find unbelievable and other people look at me and think, how could she not believe in this thing that is so obviously so clearly true? Mm-hmm. I think some people really, truly, genuinely believe. And I think that there are a lot of people like me who occupied that middle position I occupied in for a long time, who gain benefit from belonging to a community, who gain a sense of tradition, family, ritual. But maybe like they don't believe all of it, but like they like it or they believe enough of it, or that, you know, there's lots of degree. I, you know, I used to have this fascination. Again, this is like my novelist side. I would entertain myself during the hours I would sit in on synagogue every Saturday being like, I wonder if they really believed it. What are they really trying to sort of imagining my way into what people are really thinking? Because it's not something you talk about. That so much of Orthodox Judaism is about practice and about action. And so you dress a certain way and you observe the Sabbath and you keep strict kosher and you keep the holidays. And so it's very busy. I mean, there's a lot to do all the time. And so these questions of belief seem less important than they do in other religions. That was one of the fascinating things I learned and the connections I've made with people who have left other religious worlds. What I believed, like that wasn't the crucial thing. It was what I did.
There was so much to do. Like I was thinking about like just you preparing for Shabbat and all the things you had to do just to get ready to follow all the rules. I was like, that's exhausting. I don't know how anyone can do that. Like, are you supposed to have a job and do all that stuff? Like, it's a lot.
A lot of high performers.
I was a high performer.
Same with the Mormons. You know, the same thing.
I feel like the former Mormons are my people. I really feel, I know you had John DeLynn on, who I love. I was on his podcast soon
after we watched it.
Did you?
We listened to it.
It was really, it was just fascinating for me, that sense that I really had this feeling of like, you know, the vast differences in our world, but I've never had that feeling so closely of, oh, we have all the same problems. We've gone through the same thing so fully. And I really, I ended up doing an event with John in Salt Lake City. And there were like 200 former Mormons in this church. And I just felt like I have found my people. Like finally, like this is where I belong among these people.
I'm not trying to one-up you, but he had us in Salt Lake with 1,500.
Oh my God.
It was the best. And so many people said they woke up because of watching The Vow.
Right.
Like they were just watching the next docuseries or someone recommended it and they were like, oh my God, I need to get out of this. Or it helped them process what had happened. It was really wild. I see the connections now that we've done the Mormon deep dive.
It's really uncanny, these two.
It was for me that experience. And I noticed, started noticing early on that most of the emails I got were from people who had left Mormonism. And it was just this feeling that like, there was so much similarity because it wasn't, you know, I feel like leaving a religious world that has so many actions, it's not like I was going to like a Passover Seder once a year and doing a few other things. I mean, it was my everything. It was my community, my family, my deepest sense of who I was. And I feel like that was what was so shared with the Mormon people who had left Mormonism, the feeling that your own identity is somehow taken away from you and you have to recreate that. So that for me has been, I think, one of the nicest parts of having putting this book out in the world, has just this sense of such a feeling of connection and such a reminder that there's so many similarities in these experiences.
Absolutely. And the other similarity I see there is when people do start to question, it's so easy to shut it down because leaving means it's just leaving everything.
Right.
Like you're literally leaving your community or source of income. And are you familiar with this term PIMO?
Mm-mm.
Physically in and mentally out.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. So a lot of people are talking about that now, also with Jehovah's Witnesses and other similar structures of religious organizations or communities. It's that they're out. They're like, okay, I don't believe this anymore, but they can't actually leave yet because it's their job or their family or whatever. And they're trying to figure out how to not be shunned or disfellowshipped or cut off, which is always like one of the sort of trademarks of cultish behavior. It's like, what happens when you leave? Can you leave?
You have equity.
Right. I mean, in Orthodoxy, there's a term called orthoprax, where people will say like that they, you know, they practice an Orthodox lifestyle, but it always leaves the question of belief. What happens if you don't actually believe in it, but you sort of do the actions and keep your communal place or remain that feeling of inside? You know, one thing that was interesting with Mormonism was the great conversation I had with John was about the way that I am no longer part of an Orthodox community, but I very much feel like part of a Jewish world, that Mormonism, he felt like he wanted there to be like modern Mormonism, like the way there, or Reform Mormonism, the way there's Reform right. Judaism, that there's still a place within Judaism for people who don't practice in the strict way. And I think that does create a sense of maybe it's like a middle ground place where I can still feel a sense of connection to my history and tradition and family and still observe holidays, but not with that same rigid focus on rule following and where I don't have to pretend to believe something that I don't believe.
Right.
Right.
Right. There was a person, Sarah, I don't know if you remember this person, I'm not going to say their name, but they were in Nexium and they're Orthodox Jews. And he would have to walk from Brooklyn after class on Friday all the way home, which was, we were on Midtown 37th and 5th area. And he would talk about the belief and kind of roll his eyes and be like, yeah, I got to do it. But he didn't seem all in on it at all and seemed kind of judgmental with it. And the nature of what the curriculum would do would get him to question it. But there seemed to be kind of an indifference to him oftentimes to it. And I think, you know, if you're indifferent about one thing, your belief system, it can't not affect other things that you do.
But also, like, why do it?
I mean, for the reasons that we talked about, he has equity and it's his community and those sorts of things. But it's a death by a thousand cuts because I think you're going through something. And I kind of feel like that was going on with me and Nexium. There's things I didn't agree with, but I felt like overall good of what we were doing, until it clearly wasn't, was the pivot. And it freed me. And I felt free in other areas of my life. And to your point earlier on, it's kind of a reimagining yourself and a reimagining your goals and reimagining the things that were what and are important to you.
We tell our stories. We change the world. A Little Bit Culty is proud to support the hashtag I Got Out project, which empowers survivors of cultic abuse to share their stories online as a catalyst for education, prevention, and healing. Learn more about the hashtag I Got Out movement and find resources at igotout.org.
There's something soul destroying about saying, well, I'm going to just base my whole life on this thing. Like, yes. I don't really believe in it, but like, I like being invited for Friday night dinner.
It's subtle.
You know, I don't like it that much. You know, the Friday night dinner is not that great, you know,
right?
Because it does something to your own internal authenticity, your own feeling that you get to speak from your whole self. So many different times, certainly when I started writing this book, I remember asking myself this question of, am I allowed to think what I think? Like, am I allowed to feel what I feel? And it felt like, on one hand, it's such a simple question, right? I mean, the answer should be, of course you are, but it doesn't feel like that. It felt shocking, this idea that I was allowed to look at something and say, like, I don't believe that. That's not what I believe in. And I don't want to be that. I can love my family and love people who I'm so connected to, but I still get to decide what I believe in. And I still get to make choices about my own belief with my own integrity and my own desire to craft my own life. And I don't have to live in that middle space because there's something corroding about it.
It really is. It's the most subtle of corrosions too.
What do you think gave you the strength to do that, where so many people stay in that middle space?
I always feel like college would have been like the nice exit ramp, right? Like before I was married and before I had kids, like I felt like, even now looking back, I feel like, oh, I know what, if I had just done these few things differently, I would have been like, one more case of, see, the dangers of secular college, the Tova Mervis story. Mm-hmm. Look what happens when you go to a college and you study like comparative religion, you know, and like that would have been like the story. But I was afraid. I was very, very afraid of feeling lost. Mm-hmm. I did not have the confidence. I didn't have the sense that I could stand on my own. And getting married, I mean, it just took away the need to know anything else. It just felt like the fantasy of like the young married couple was so enshrined in Orthodoxy. I mean, it was it's so beautiful. And like, you set your Friday night dinner table with your wedding china and you have family and you're protected from all the problems of the outside. And you have this little cocoon bathed in the candlelight and on and on and on. It's so enormously compelling. And I went for it. It just felt like it was an insurance policy almost against my own self, if that makes sense, against what I might do.
Wow.
What a line.
Wow. Well put.
Right. And so it took a lot longer for me. I think part of it was having kids. I mean, on one hand, when you have kids, then it was like up to me to teach them. And I'm the one who's supposed to teach them things and keep them inside this world. And so many memories of sitting with one of my kids where they asked me a question about, you know, with my middle son, it was like, why can't I eat the non-kosher pizza? I was laughing about your Sarma interview. I was laughing about the Sarma, you know, how it all came down to pizza. I was like, God, why is pizza, it always coming down to pizza? Like, you know, my son Daniel saying to me, you know, why can't I eat it? And I know with one part of my mouth, the answer I'm supposed to give him about tradition and rules and restriction. And the other part of my mouth is thinking like, eat the goddamn pizza. Like, what is this? You know, what am I doing? And that, that feeling of being so separated inside myself. And I think there were just enough moments. For me, it was probably a case of like, you know, a straw breaking the camel's back, the feeling of the accumulation. And it was right before I turned 40. I just came upon this feeling that I could not. Almost like it wasn't a choice. There were different moments when I was supposed to perform a ritual. I was supposed to do something. I was supposed to mostly to say something. I was supposed to articulate an Orthodox position as a writer in some ways. And I was like, I cannot. Like, it does not come out of my mouth. Like, the falseness that was required. I think my whole life I had been afraid that if I did not adhere, it would fall apart. And maybe you have to get to the point where you're willing for it to fall apart, where it's okay. Yep. If it, like, yes, it will fall apart and that is okay.
I didn't realize it was just before you turned 40, which is also when I left NXIVM was just before I turned 40. Yeah.
Maybe there's something about that birthday. You know?
I don't know. It means something. I don't know what it means yet. But I mean, I found so many parallels with our journeys and also as a mother too, like those moments that you were able to share, you know, the inner I don't have the words like you do, but you know, even with that pizza moment where he said something like, will you still love me if I eat cheese or meat pizza? And I'm like, oh, my heart just broke with the pain of wanting to protect, but also guide and love, and separate from your story, there's also these nuggets of the challenges of being a mother that I found really compelling.
You know, on one hand, like as parents, we raise our kids in things we believe in. Every group does it, every religion, if non-religion, we teach our children what we think. But there's always the moment, I have older kids now, of recognizing like they get to pick for themselves. I can tell them what I think, but I do not get to choose their lives for them. I mean, it's hard as a parent.
It's hard.
Two kids in college right now, and my daughter is 14, recognizing that they are becoming themselves and I can share with them what I care about. I'm never going to attach love to it. It can't be like, you have to have my politics or I don't love you. You know, I might be annoyed or think, how can you think that? Or I can argue with them about something, but they are their own independent beings who get the right to choose for themselves. I mean, it's one of the hard parts about parenting. And certainly, you know, when you do come from a very particular world, that tension between wanting to pass on something and pass on tradition or family or a sense of connection to something, and yet also wanting to give independence.
Yeah. Someone asked you that during the Mormon interview about your two kids, and apparently you have one that's Orthodox or flirting with it, and the other one that's totally not, says we're a simulation or something.
Right.
I forget what it was, but the way you answered that question, I'd love for you to expand on that and how you handled the beliefs. It was very impressive.
My book, my kids were little kids. Now I have big kids. I have a senior in college, a freshman in college, and a 14-year-old.
Wow.
And
wow,
my oldest son is Orthodox. And I feel like my job is to support that. Doesn't mean I have to agree with it or want to believe in it. But he, of his own free will and his own thought, has chosen this world that's his family world. And I do feel like I will do anything I can to ease that for him. It doesn't mean that I'm dishonest with him about he knows exactly what I believe or what I think. I feel like my role as his mom is to support him. In my house, our kitchen is strictly kosher. And it's sort of the irony of life is that I am the kosher police officer now because my husband and his three kids are all secular Jews. And some, I'm the one who's like, oh, you can't use that pot with that spoon. And I think, I can't believe that I am the one who has to do this, but I do it for the sake of family. I do it so that the kitchen is a place, but I always feel like, oh, you get what you deserve, Tobin. Now you're the one who has to like do this kind of thing.
You do it so you can host there and people will feel,
exactly.
That's so kind.
Exactly. I do it so that my son, this is my son's home, and I do it so that my parents will come here and eat here and that they feel comfortable.
Oh,
but
I
mean, we have takeout in the other room. You know, it's not like everyone is only eating kosher food, but I keep the kitchen itself, the cooking parts kosher because I care about family. But it's a complicated straddle on who bends and who doesn't bend and who has to give. It's a never ending family fun to, you know, to play this game of figuring it out. But my middle son is a freshman at Michigan and he is not interested in religion. I mean, he went to a sort of a community Jewish high school that he loved, but he's not religious in any way. And he will become himself. He has lots of things he's passionate about. He's always been like a questioner. He was one who asked me about non-kosher pizza. And he was asking, of course, a much bigger question than pizza. I took him for non-kosher pizza at that time, felt like a radical transgression. It felt like I was doing something completely radical. And I told him that we only could get vegetarian pizza because that was sort of like a misdemeanor. It wasn't an all and out like felony to get this kind of thing. So I was very unsure of what to do. And you know, his little face like kind of took in my rule and he said, lean down, mom. And he said, if one day when I'm a grown up, I eat pizza with meat on it, will you still love me? I felt like that's the question, right? Like, can you be different? Like, this is the choice I'm making.
But yeah.
I'm not going to tie love to religious observance. Like, I will love you whoever you are. And you get the right as you get older to choose that. It's funny, that piece was actually in the New York Times in a Modern Love column. And it was fascinating to see the feedback. I mean, people feel many ways about that story and about pizza. I got a message on my Facebook page. Luckily, I didn't know how to read my like spam Facebook file for a long time. And I finally was like, oh, what are these messages here? Let's see what, you know, what has shown up in here. And someone was like, you know, I feel like you're jumping off a cliff with your child. And I was like, really? Really? You think that's what this is? It was a contentious subject, that question of what does it mean to not believe yourself, but to not require your children to stay inside as well? You know, parenting becomes very complicated when one parent is leaving a religious world and the kids have been raised in it.
It's actually one thing that really stuck out with me throughout is your generosity with the people around you having different opinions. Like I remember somebody asked you in another interview, like, are you angry? And certainly Nippy and I have been very angry at times towards our former community and people who were at our wedding that shun us now and things like that. And you said something about free, I'm just looking for the quote, but maybe you remember it off the top of your head, about freedom is letting other people also think for themselves and have their own beliefs. I mean, that's what I would strive for. Like I would actually love, Nippy and I are actually not on the same page with this, but I would love to communicate with, there are people who are still, you know, in, even though Keith is in jail, I'd love to be able to communicate with them and them say, yeah, I believe this. And be like, yeah, I actually don't believe that anymore. And this is why, and converse, but I can't. And I wonder how you got to that position of feeling so, or it seems to be so like generously respectful.
Sarah, when I was listening to you talk about how so many people were at your wedding and that feeling of being cut off and just looking, seeing the pictures, that feeling of it, that it was your family, right? I mean, it was the people you were so close to. And I was curious, I think on the episode I was listening to this morning where you talked about having forgiven Lauren, right? And I was so interested in that question for you. I remember when you said I get to ask you a question, maybe here
this
it is.
Be it.
Right. Yeah. That question of like, what does that forgiveness feel like when someone you trusted put you in such harm's way or, you know, did something to you? And it's a complicated question, right? About forgiveness and what we forgive and when does holding on to the anger hurt us? Someone said, oh, you don't seem like someone who could get angry. I was like, okay, that is so, trust me, I have a lot of anger about lots of parts of my story and anger about many things. But for me, it was a question of when does that holding on to that anger hurt me? When am I just sort of stewing in it or on fire with it as opposed to letting it go? And I, you know, was just curious for you guys where you feel that sense of where anger fits into it, or where do you forgive, or do you feel they too were so caught up in this way?
That's the ultimate process, right? So for me, I think it's indicative of how much you've reconciled your own process, because if you can forgive them, like if you understand what happened to you, then you understand what happened to them and you can have the requisite compassion for that. And I hold space for that. I don't really feel angry. And I'll use Lauren in this example, angry at Lauren. And I actually want her to get back on her feet because I think she's a very intelligent person, capable person. I'd love to see her thrive. All that said, I don't know that I'm at a place where I can let people back into my life who use their psychology to want us to see harm and to had behaviors that were in line with wanting to see us in jail, knowing us, knowing our family, marrying us and all that stuff. I have a hard time with that because I never did that with my psychology towards people that left previously and even people that were angry at me. I didn't do that. And I know that to some people I can come off as, you know, hothead and even an asshole at time, and that's fine. And I would even agree with some of those people and fair enough, but I didn't do that with my mind and psychology at any point during this. You know, I was pissed and, you know, I was upset my wife was doing that. So, you know, maybe if I saw her and I felt her energy and I knew that, you know, that was to the agree that she got quote conned or whatever. And I have in my head a little bit, but I just don't know. And that's kind of where I delineate.
It's also been 5 years.
Yeah.
Like that we've gone through all different stages. I've gone through very angry, yeah. Like feeling so betrayed by my best friend that she could have done that.
You asked me a year ago, it was a different answer. And you might ask me in a year from now, it might be a different answer too.
But there certainly was a big shift when she wrote the letter, right?
She wrote you a letter.
Right. She wrote me a letter, but it was also extended to you and Troy,
yeah.
You know, apologizing and taking responsibility fully. And that's when I like let go of all anger and you know, she owned what she did and was clear about why she did it and not in a blamey, victim-y way. But she also was a victim to Keith. Like she was quite young when she got under his grasp. All the women were quite young.
It's hard not to feel compassion for that.
Yeah.
Because I think Lauren is a person that probably wanted a family at one point and maybe she still can, I don't know. But the best years of her life were being abused. You know, I was friends with her, I was close to her. It's hard not to feel compassion for her in that regard.
For me, I felt like in writing the book, I wanted to not write for my anger. I wanted to sort of try to write a book from maybe from the sadness. I felt like sadness was almost like a better tool for me as a writer to use. I feel like for some people who believe in a religious world, who belong to a religious community, whether it's religious Mormonism or evangelical Christianity, I feel like people believe in religion. And that is what they can live. And I can let that be. For me, it is not a world I believe in. But I still feel sometimes that sense of longing for, you know, what it would have meant to be, to match my family, to be more similar. And so I can feel the sadness of that without that in any way implying that I want to be part of it still, or that I'm willing to live that feeling of pretend or lack of authenticity for myself. You know, it's hard when there are parts of something you can long for, even if you don't want the whole in any way, if you don't want to re-enter it in any way.
Sure.
I am curious to know how you put your life back together, or not even back together, created your new life, and how you chose what to keep and not keep. And before I do, I just wanted to say something that you reminded me about the evangelical Christians. We'd gotten feedback from some past episodes that they felt like we were, you know, really shitting on uncertain like IFB and evangelical Christians in general. And I want to like also be really clear that this podcast is not about the good stuff.
Right.
Part of it is because we do like people to understand like what's the hook and why do people join these things either or stay in these things. And that's important to understand. But we're here to talk about the abuses of power or like the things that aren't working. And also to say as a caveat, like if you're in something and in a religion, in a community, and you're truly happy, great. I want that for people. I want people to feel whole and complete and full of purpose. Right. And if there's something that needs to be looked at, you need to look at it. Obviously, you weren't being abused, you weren't hurt, but there was something that wasn't truthful or authentic for you that you had to acknowledge and have this like painful separation to find yourself, right? And that's a really beautiful thing. And yeah, and this is also tricky for me. Our son is at a Jewish private school. And I don't know who listens to this. And I want to be respectful of different people's choices and religions. And at the same time, I feel like it's really important to always be critically thinking. And that, of course, is ironic for us because we were in a course that we thought we were learning critical thinking.
Right. Right.
And yet we weren't allowed to critically think about a few certain key points that kept us in this closed system of logic.
And I think it's important for religious communities to be able to ask themselves, are we using tactics that are problematic? How are we drawing people in, or what happens to those who question? And that, you know, certainly is something that I think about so much. You know, if you want to belong to a religious community and it fills you with meaning, that's great. But what is your relationship to the person, whether it's your friend, your child, your spouse, your parent, who doesn't believe? Is there room mm-hmm. in your worldview to make space for the fact that I choose this? This is the truth as far as I'm concerned. And yet I don't have to malign the person who looks at the mm-hmm. same set of non-scientifically provable facts mm-hmm. and says, I don't believe in this. And, mm-hmm. you know, where do we make space for that possibility? I mean, for me as a kid, one of the things that was like made me the craziest was this idea that like, I know it's the truth because I'm born into it, but like, what are the odds that I would have been the one born into the truth? Like, and like those kids who go to like St. Louis Catholic school down the street from me, like, they think they have the truth and they are told it's the truth, but they have to be wrong because I'm right. And like that sort of mind game of like, how could this be? Or like recognizing when I was talking to all my new Mormon friends that they looked at me in the same way that I had looked at them. It's like mind altering. Right. And so how do we make space for the beliefs or non-beliefs of other people? And that's what I feel like religious communities have worked to do on that question of the role of the doubter or the dissenter in their midst. How do we relate to those people?
I agree. It seems consistent in a lot of these things. The very tools that the religions try to instill in the kids are ultimately the ones, if the kids use them, end up turning on to question the very foundation. And they're all going to be at risk at that at a certain point if they're truly embracing the tools that they profess, which is the pursuit of truth. So they kind of have the built-in elixir to the poison, if you will.
Right. When you teach people to think, then you get people who can think.
Careful.
Right. And that
right.
that has to be the way it is. Or, you know, I've had that argument with people about religious art. The point of art is, you know, I've taped up to my desk right here, the job of the artist is always to deepen the mystery, you know, by Francis Bacon. I feel like the job of the artist is to complicate it. And like, you can't say like, mm-hmm. we want to keep it nice and neat and simple and still say, oh no, but we want art. Like the job is to make it more complicated and mm-hmm. to say like, not always so black and white.
Good job, artist.
Right.
right. The casualties to their cause and their religion are oftentimes the most critical thinkers.
Right. The people who leave. And do we resort to shunning? Do we have to create like an us versus them mentality, a black and white world? Do they have mm-hmm. to be cast as dangers? You know, one of my pet peeves. This is one of my chat my asses. I can actually tell you.
Tell us. Tell us what chapter
oh,
ass.
Here we go.
I'm like saying that phrase out loud. I'm saying it constantly.
A natural segue.
Chapping my ass is, it's something that you said. I don't remember which of my 2 weeks of deep dive into your world. But the idea that, you know, you must have just had a bad experience. This is the truth.
Right.
But your experience is the anomaly. The dissenting one is just because there's something wrong with you. You must have had a bad experience or for so many rituals I was told, but it's beautiful. And if you don't think so, you know, but it is, it's beautiful. And so what must be wrong with you?
Why can't you see it?
Right. There must be something wrong with you in that sense of not being able to make space for like the craziness of different people think different things without having to resort to these sort of attacks on, you know, that this is, you don't really disbelieve. You just must have somehow like gotten, someone must have been mean to you or you were abused or some other reason why. Because it's not possible that you could disbelieve this religion that is so ironclad somehow.
Yes. We didn't actually get to what was the final straw, actually. Like, and that's something we ask all our guests. Like, what was the ultimate thing that where you decided to leave? And I'd love to also hear about and share with our listeners the moment where you broke Shabbat and turned on your phone in the bathroom, which some people may not understand what that means exactly. Can you bring us back there?
Sure. One of the things, but because Orthodoxy has so many rules, there's so many ways to transgress, but they're so small. They almost seem laughable because in my mind, these were enormous. I mean, using my phone, hiding in the bathroom on a Friday past sundown was like, you know, as bad as you could be.
That's a gangster move. In that
radical. All I did was like, I read like, I looked at the New York Times website. It's like, that's your big moment. That's what you're going to do. But yes, that was what I did. But that was like, you know, the transgression. A lot of times people talk about the big transgressions as being having to do with food because, you know, there's lots of strict laws about keeping kosher, which involve not mixing meat and milk foods and not eating certain meats, not eating any kind of pig product or ham or bacon. But a lot of it also is about if you keep Orthodox kosher, it's you only eat food that's certified as kosher. Like you only eat at a restaurant that's kosher. So there are 4 kosher restaurants in Boston. So you only eat in those. And, you know, one of my big rebellions was I had like the organic tofu in a non-kosher restaurant. And everyone's like, you didn't have a cheeseburger? You didn't go for like the pork ribs?
Bacon?
Like, no, I had the tofu. And like, it's so small, these transgressions. And yet to me, they loomed enormously. They felt like I could not have been like a more controversial, more radical rebel than to eat that bite of tofu. I mean, it was just, it was good. It was really good.
Have you ever tried bacon? I'm just curious.
No, because I've been a vegetarian for so long.
Oh, right. You're vegetarian, right.
So that, I mean, it's funny, like with vegetarianism.
That'd be a big jump.
Right. Like I believe in it. Like I actually genuinely, legitimately believe in being a vegetarian. So I have no desire to break it because I care about it. But yes, I became a vegetarian when I was still keeping kosher. So I missed my chance to try Memphis barbecue. People are like, you're from Memphis and you never had barbecue? We're like, no, I have not.
I respect that.
I think the straw that breaks the camel's back, there were so many accumulations. There was just this constant feeling of one little thing stacking on top of another little thing. I guess two moments come to mind. Both are in my book, but one of them is every month I would go to the mikvah, which is like the ritual bath, which is one of the pillars of Orthodox family life, that a woman goes to the ritual bath a week or depending on various complicated countings to the ritual bath after her period before you can have sex with your husband. Mm-hmm. It's called the laws of family purity. And it really, your whole sex life basically revolves around it, like when you're allowed to touch and when you're not allowed to touch. And that, again, one of these things that was just a given for me. It was just what you did. Even though I chafed at it, I would think, I hate doing this. I don't want to do this, but I would do it because it was a given. And there are lots of rules governing a woman's body in this regard. You have to clip your fingernails. You have to scrub off any calluses. You can't have contacts in or jewelry. The water has to cover you. And, you know, it's one of those things, again, like that I've always been told is beautiful. Like, this is beautiful. And the Tova voice that was willing to be honest would think, I don't feel like this is beautiful, but it's beautiful. Mm. And there's almost this inner battle that happens between what I'm supposed to officially be feeling and what I was privately feeling, the sense of, I don't experience this as beautiful. I don't like doing this. I don't want to do this. And yet there must be something wrong with me because I cannot experience this as beautiful because I am told this is beautiful. But you can see that combing my hair is not the easiest of feats. I have very curly hair, but you have to comb your hair because there can't be a tangle in it because then the water can't fully cover you. And so I had, you know, I hack away at my hair every month trying to get it untangled, but it doesn't want to do that. And then there was just one time when there's a woman who said the mikvah lady is called, but is the attendant who, I was so close to being on the edge. If she had known, she would not have messed with me. If she knew that I was dangling by a thread at that point, dangling in my marriage by a thread, dangling in this world. But she sort of touched my hair and said, you know, it's tangled. Can you comb it any better? And it just, I think there are moments when our bodies revolt, when it wasn't an option. I normally would have agreed, would have done it or just done a halfway job. But it was like every part of me was rising up and just this, like the word no was just all I could say, that I couldn't, I wasn't going to, I could not do it anymore. And I just told her no. I was like, I can't. And that, I guess that moment stands in for me for so many times when I just felt like I had waited until I reached the edge, until it didn't even feel like a choice. It just felt like I had come to some kind of impossibility of staying inside. You know, it wasn't like I could do something to do with the kitchen or the stove or the holidays. I could do that, but this was my body. I couldn't do anything else when it was about the laws on my body, like not for another minute, really.
Hey, culty listeners, lovers of cult-busting content, ALBCers, culty kids, we've gotten a lot of requests to put up a link where people can throw some funds up behind the podcast and help support what Little Bit Culty is doing. And you know what? That's a great idea. Thank you for that. And as we've gotten to know other podcasters and learn more about this whole podcast thing, we've been learning that it takes a whole lot of different resources and different sources of revenue and listener support to keep it rolling. Sponsorships and ads and the occasional appeal to amazeballs listeners like you. That's why we added a way for anyone who wants to support the show to do exactly that. You can go to littlebitculty.com/support or the link in our Instagram bio, or smash that link in our show notes to make a one-time contribution or a recurring one. We will pay your support forward with a galactic level of love and light and healing resources, of course. Again, it's littlebitculty.com/support or check out the link in our Instagram bios. Next up, we really got to figure out what to call you, our listenership. ALBC Nation? Flying Monkeys? We're going to have to workshop that. Thanks, guys. That moment certainly stuck out. And I realized as you were talking about that, that we had asked you to read from your book about 30 minutes ago. Okay. And then we got on a tangent.
I can still, if you want, we have time if you want me
would
to.
You? Sure. Would you? Yeah. And then I have like one more burning question.
A note I want to make there too, Sarah, it often comes down to, particularly with women, when it comes to my body.
Yeah, that's true.
It's off limits. That's really when NXIVM came down. It was the physical abuses. Once you reconcile the physical abuses, you start to take inventory on the emotional abuses that led to that point.
Right. If you submit to an authority figure, whether it's in your case to Keith mm-hmm. Raniere or whether it's religious law, when you submit yourself to authority, mm-hmm. who has control of your body? Who has jurisdiction over the most private parts of yourself? And for me, so many of the laws that I really chafed at were about dress codes, skirt length, about, you know, wearing sleeveless. Am I probably the only person who uses the word sleeveless? For me, that word is like the most delicious world.
You must love wearing tank tops now.
Oh my God. I am like a huge fan of tank tops because it's a sense of freedom over my body, of getting to decide. And Sarah, you know what? You know, the opening of your book where you describe that scene of being branded, I feel like it was so, you know, so riveting and so powerful, and that it really took us so fully into the sense of what happens when you surrender or lose or forced to lose control over your own body, over being in charge of your most private part of yourself. And that I think so often, as you said, like this breaking point moment, for me, it was just combing my hair. It was nothing like what you were experiencing. But I think those moments when we're asked to do something that really trespass on our sense of control over our physical bodies.
Absolutely.
Right.
Thank you. This is like therapy for me. Thank you for saying that. Okay, let's let Tova read.
You were supposed to believe that this way of life was the only true way. You were supposed to tell yourself that the rituals and restrictions were binding and beautiful. And if you felt any rumbling of dissatisfaction, you were supposed to believe that the problem lay with you. My own discontent, I hoped, remained well hidden. It wasn't the sort of thing I would have shared, because along with the actual rules, there was another set of laws, equally stringent, yet more unforgiving, enforced not by a belief in God, but by communal eyes that were just as all-seeing and all-knowing. Inside my head, a voice constantly whispered, "What will they think?" I tried to force back my burst of doubt to locate the spot where I was getting lost. Did I believe there was a God? Did I believe there was a God involved in the world? Did I believe there was a God who revealed his word to Moses on Mount Sinai? Did I believe these laws were binding on me? "We all believe," claimed the prayers that were sung around me. "Do we really?" asked the voice, growing more brazen inside me. There was no fighting it. It was a late doubt, slow in asserting itself. But now it broke through me, pushed me, dared me. What if someone, me for instance, were to take on the role of heckler in this synagogue where I stood, yell out that, in fact, I wasn't so sure? The stalwarts all around me would shush me, all disturbances quashed, all dissent hidden away. But surely inside some of these minds as well burn this same strange fire, these same doubt-riddled thoughts.
That's exactly what I wanted. And there was also that line somewhere else about how you didn't even need to be watched all the time because you had surveillance in your skin.
Right.
And I feel like that's how, whether we call it gaslighting mm-hmm. or you also talked about like the little miniature rabbi in your mind.
Right.
Right. You can picture that. And then next to him, there's a question about what is a conscience? Mm-hmm. And I remember somebody saying, and this sort of became my thing ever since, he's like, it's kind of like a little silver robot that lives in your brain. And like tells you what's right and wrong. And I wondered, are those rabbis like fully eradicated from your psyche, or do they pop up every now and then?
Right. I wish I could say, oh, it's fully eradicated. It's like your voice, and depends on the day. I mean, I feel like with all these kinds of leavings, one thing that, you know, struck me so much with talking to people who've left religious world is, you know, I'm curious if this speaks to your experience as well, that you don't leave something all at once. Like you leave, no. You leave again. And I feel like years go by and I have a moment where I'm leaving again. Like I feel like I'm always mm-hmm. in the stage of further leave taking. And you know, for me, for a long time, I would drive on Saturdays. The first time I did it, I was like, oh God, the car works on Saturday. Like who knew? Like mm-hmm. that, you know, like the laws of physics still let me drive this car on Saturday. But I couldn't drive it in a neighborhood where I might see someone who was part of the Orthodox community. I would take the long way around and I would feel silly doing it. I would feel, even after my book came out, I was like, who exactly am I hiding from? I have written a book where I described this exact scene, but I couldn't do it. And now I can. I mean, I look around me. I'm still aware of that strangeness of being publicly breaking these rules that really shaped me. But I think for all of us who've left something that has shaped us so much, I think that maybe we're always in the process of leaving. There's always little threads that hold on, and we, with time, leave more or change our understanding of it. And God, it's been a long time. It's been, I guess, 10 years since the first floodgate opened for me. But I still feel like I'm leaving. I still feel like it's a long process. of deciding what pieces of it I remain connected mm-hmm. to, how to maintain connections to people who I, you know, care so much about, and how to constantly bolster the part of me that is able to stand on my own outside of this sort of strong communal structure, to live with uncertainty, to live with the question of, I don't have all the answers. I don't know mm-hmm. the truth of the world. I'm not presuming to know those mm-hmm. things. I don't have to have an answer for, you know, why do bad things happen to good people? Like, mm-hmm. I don't have to offer like a, you know, a little pat answer to these kinds of questions. And I can live without that kind of presume certainty about the world.
And how do you feel about community right. now? Or have you found a new one or new ones? What's that word mean now to you?
It's funny. It's a loaded word for me. It's a yeah, mixed yeah. bag. I mean, I crave community. You know, I think one of the things that kept me, and I know kept so many people inside religious world, again, thinking about my Mormon friends, is that sense of community where even if you didn't believe in it, community almost could be the God that you didn't believe in. It could take the role of that. And in moments of need, in moments of sickness and family gatherings, I mean, there is something really special about that kind of belonging. But you know, for me, I would say, well, at what cost, right? You belong to a community, but then you belong to that community. And what happens when you belong to that? And so I feel like I've slowly created different kinds of communities. It's much mm-hmm. looser. I don't feel like, you know, the community, this sort of like all mm-hmm. caps, you know, community that people will talk about. I have different communities. I have a writer's community of people who I'm connected to, who I love as That's writers good. And friends. Before the pandemic, I had a gym community, and I would sort of joke to my husband that my gym was my new synagogue, that I would go, you know, religiously to the gym. And it was a different kind of community. It was based on a different interest. We had a mm-hmm. shared interest in working out. And I think I was trained to feel like, well, that doesn't count. You know, that's not a real sure. community. That's only about something as insignificant as like working out. But like, that's a community. Like, that was a nice thing.
Don't tell
thing.
Nippy that.
Right.
Oh, really?
yeah. Nippy's very, very religious with his
right.
sure. his fitness.
Yeah. Right. I was there was a trainer. Yeah. I would go to these group training classes, and I was like, he's the rabbi. The other yeah. person's the yeah. assistant rabbi. You know, it was like yeah. my little world that we were, you know, we would
I love that.
Running joke. But I think that maybe in some ways, like the antidote to the fear of leaving a world is that you're told that you'll never belong anywhere. You'll be all alone forever. You know, you will right. never have people to connect to. And I think it's recognizing there's so many different ways we forge connection, and that religion doesn't have a lock on community, and that I can find other ways to feel a sense of community.
For
and
sure.
I have to find that more for myself. I do sometimes. And I think I'm much more comfortable, certainly post or because of the pandemic, being alone. I mean, so much I feel like mm-hmm. of being a writer is like, I sit in this room. I have to write my book. I'm working on a novel. I feel like just sit, do not move out of this room for 5 hours and just work on your book. And that is its own form of connection. It might not be to people at a, you know, Sabbath dinner table, but it's also a connection to the world and a connection to myself, to what I want to be pursuing and what I want to be doing.
You just shared some really good advice to people. And I'm wondering if there's anything else you would say. I would want to know about any messages you'd have to former members or former friends who don't talk to you. But really, if I could distill it to one piece of advice you may have for someone who's still in anything and questioning, and the community thing you just said is one piece of it. Is there anything else you'd say that might bolster people or give them strength to either to leave or to feel like some sage advice for what's on the other side?
Well, I feel like that idea that you can listen to your own voice, you can listen to that voice of doubt. It feels enormously scary to maybe make change and to maybe really examine a question. But the flip side of it is even worse. Having to constantly quiet that voice is really a right. really hard way to live, to feel that somehow you are a threat to your own mind, that to really explore something and to really be able to ask yourself questions. And, you know, for so long, you know, I've certainly felt like this in my first marriage. My mantra to myself was nothing can change. I would sort of hunker down mm-hmm. about this idea that I would be unhappy about things. And I was like, well, nothing can change. Nothing can change. And
yeah.
And it was sort of shocking to us how wrong I was, that things can change, that you can change yeah. things. I don't want to, you know, sugarcoat it. Like, it's enormously unsettling to leave something, to leave a marriage. I mean, to get divorced with children is a hard process to go through, but we can go through things. You know, I think for me, the greatest pleasure is knowing that I am allowed to think what I think, that I am allowed mm-hmm. to feel what I feel and to believe what I believe, that I don't have to constantly be quieting that so that I can match some external version of who I'm supposed to be.
Is that true freedom?
I think it is, right? What would be a better freedom? Like, maybe it starts there, right? If you can't think, if my thoughts, even inside my own mind, are not safe. I mean, I don't even feel that sense of freedom in my head, how can I ever feel free in any other capacity?
I'm wondering how you feel about Passover now and just sort of the metaphors of that story. And for those, anyone who's listening who doesn't know, it's if they've watched Disney's The Prince of Egypt.
Is that like, I think that's the one.
That's the one that sort of tells this story most people have without getting too into the weeds of it. How do you feel about Passover now and the story and what you've gone through?
I guess like with so many of the holidays, you know, it used to be that I would think about the rules of them. I have to follow these rules and this is what it has to be. And everything has to comply with this very, very particular set of guidelines. And that would be the role of them. Now I regard the holidays the way like maybe I regard like July 4th or Thanksgiving, like not yeah. so up on like the details. Like, could I make a critique of Thanksgiving? Like, sure I could, but like I regard it as like a family holiday. And I can recognize my separateness from parts of the holiday or parts of the rules and yet still connect as a cultural tradition, as a family thing, as a historical, as a sort of a story. I feel like it's like a mythology about Jewish peoblehood and Jewish connection and this story about freedom, which is ironic because for so many people, I think they often feel enslaved by the rules of the holiday that's supposed to be mm-hmm. about freedom. But I can decide yes. to connect to the parts of it that I want to be part of. I think it's a holiday about storytelling, about telling generations telling a story, and I can connect to those parts. And I want to celebrate it with my family. And so I do. I think I can enter an environment where the rules are followed, but as long as I don't have to pretend, as long as I don't have yeah. to pretend like, oh, yes, right. yes, I also care very much about the exact details. That's the soul-destroying part. Like, mm-hmm. I feel like honesty is the antidote to that. Like, my parents know. Of course they know I'm not observing. I'm observing with them, that I'm there with mm-hmm. them because I want to be with my family, but that I'm not... I don't regard it in the same way, or I don't have the same strict observance of the rules.
I think you nailed it. Anytime there's pretend it's just...
Right. That's the killer, right?
Well, I don't think that either Nippy or I realized how much, especially towards the end, at least for me, I'll speak for myself, that I was pretending. I was
right.
pretending to be a good girl and like, you know, taking notes, but really I was like making to-do lists for things, you know, like the back of the room, I was pretending to listen, but I actually was doing other things in my notebook because I was so bored.
Right.
I feel like we're getting through school.
Yeah. Right. And I'm sure you had an awareness yeah. of the consequences, right? If you were to say what you thought, like the consequences oh, yeah. are large. I mean, there's a reason why we don't do those things. You know, there are so many reasons why we don't speak our truths or say what we really think because we are so aware of what we lose in doing that.
Yeah. There was certainly a sense of how we would be tacitly punished in front of the group if we were to speak out. So you're going to squelch, 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 squelch. In fact, I wouldn't even say that I enjoyed Passover or Passover meant anything to me until I left Nexium. And the word freedom had a meaning to me that I'd never experienced before. So right. I'm curious now after reading your book, I will bring you to right. your story and relate to it very differently now, I think. So I feel really grateful that first of all, met John DeLynn and the Mormon community. Right. And through them, I met the Good Book Club. And they're the ones that referred me to you. And of course, we'd wanted to do an episode on Unorthodox Judaism and still, I think, may do more. And as I understand the difference between modern Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox and Hasidic Orthodox. And I don't know if you're familiar with this Lev Tahor thing that's happening right now.
I am, yeah. I mean, yeah, I think that, you know, the Orthodox world spans the spectrum. And so if I place myself kind of at the modern Orthodox left-wing edge, it goes very yeah. far to the more extremist section. Mm-hmm. There's been a few Netflix shows about it, but there's a wonderful memoir by a writer named Shulam Dean called All Who Go, Do Not Return. And wow. it's about his leaving the ultra-Orthodox community. And there, I feel like you see even more stringent sense of what it means mm-hmm. to leave, even more of a sense of punishments for leaving, whether they are shunning from families, family estrangements. The other thing that really, really chaps my ass is people who lose their children in custody battles when they leave the Orthodox community. That Ugh. I would say
that's
is
horrific.
When my anger comes out, it is about that, where secular judges will rule in favor of the religious spouse to award custody because they are funded by communities. The religious spouse receives enormous funding from the community to save the souls of these children. And I know of a case just this week, actually, I was reading about where parents, mothers or fathers who are not religious will often lose their custody of their children taken away from them. And I find it such a travesty that secular courts would weigh in about religion, but that they would privilege religious practice over a parental bond.
How does that need to change? Like, what do we do about that?
I will often see Facebook GoFundMe accounts. And I feel like because the parent who has left, in two cases that come to mind, both the parents both came out as gay. And that, of course, added fuel to the fire. But it is horrific. horrific to me, horrific to see parents who are stripped of their parental rights by a secular court, not even by a religious world. And yes, that is my biggest trapping of ass.
A lot of these are protected by governments. Government needs education on what these things look like. They consistently get it wrong.
Right. That feeling that these parents are asked to adhere to religious rules and custody agreements as if the courts should have any say whatsoever in religious practice. The ultra-Orthodox world has more of these cases because of mm-hmm. the distinction between modern Orthodoxy, which is much more involved in the secular world, versus ultra-Orthodoxy, which is mm-hmm. far more insular, where it's much less likely that people right. will have gone to college or will have the same resources that someone like who comes from the modern Orthodox world like me.
Is that where the series based on the book Unorthodox?
Yes.
Is that where that falls in?
Okay. Yeah, so that was part of the ultra-Orthodox world. Mm-hmm. I didn't see this, but there was the show My Unorthodox Life. It was too triggering for me. Mm-hmm. I couldn't watch it when it came out. It was like a reality show.
Oh, man.
When it came out this past summer, everyone kept texting me, "Are you watching it?" And I was like, I cannot do this.
Yeah, fair.
You know, and there was a huge defensive reaction to it. It's not like that. She's, you know, she's crazy or she's bad or whatever it is.
Of course.
But I think,
she's crazy.
You're always crazy. It's always the answer. But I think that world, I think that would be an interesting thing to explore. There's also a great memoir by a writer, Leah Vincent, called Cut Me Loose, about leaving that world. And so there have been a number of memoirs about leaving the ultra-Orthodox community as well.
Well, we certainly have more homework to do, especially with the Lev Tahor situation. For those who don't know, it's extreme, correct me if I'm wrong, right-wing, and also like there's child abuse. And
it's
all
an
sorts
extremist
of, like,
sect, yes. Like extremist the far sect,
yeah.
Edge,
yeah. Yeah,
yeah. And when I saw videos from that, I mean, my heart, like, right. I can't even talk about it. I'm going to cry. But like, we did speak to some people who are advocates for exposing this group, and nobody would talk to us because they're still too afraid, because it's like happening right now. And there's ex-members that have escaped. But like, you know, that's such a far different world, which I think is good for people to understand. Like even Christianity and Mormonism, there's such a spectrum of
exactly.
extreme, and people who don't know, like, oh, you're Jewish. Like, are you part of that?
Right.
You know, like, I'm right. like, actually, I eat bacon and I have a Christmas tree. So
a little different, right? There's,
yeah,
right.
Little
there's,
different.
Such a, there's such a range, right? And even I mean, the Jewish world, but even within the Orthodox world, there's just like my modern Orthodox world to Lev Tahor is like, feels like yeah. a million miles away.
For sure.
You know, that there's such a difference between these different parts of the world that all fall under this umbrella of Orthodox.
Yes. And then also even in the Reform and secular, like just to clarify, we also have dreidels on the Christmas tree and a menorah. And
right.
it's the whole thing. But all that to say, even though we did come from very different worlds with all these rules, like I said to you on the phone the other day, everything you spoke about, a lot of it I knew. There's more backstory that explains some things, but everything, the ceremonies you mentioned, I was aware of them. They just weren't rules for me. It was just
right.
like, you know, we trick or treat and we light the candles. We have this whole range of things. But regardless of that, like you said at the beginning, just to wrap up, circle back, it's a universal truth. It's a universal struggle to leave, to find yourself, to know yourself, to grapple with these big questions. What is good? What is bad? You know, what if there aren't answers? How do we live in this society? I really hope that people read your book and have the same meaningful connection to you, to your story, and the catharsis that I felt with going through that journey with you.
Thank you.
The compassion that you demonstrate too is one of the things that stood out to me.
Thank you. When people are real, like when we actually share our real stories, when you like push aside all of the like posing and pretending, like that sense that people go through a lot of things and we all are trying to find our way and want to understand things or understand parts of ourselves. I love what you're doing with the podcast. You know, the idea of like telling stories is how we do that. Like it's through storytelling and through people sharing their experiences, because it's so easy to feel like I'm the only one who feels this way or I'm all alone in it. And like your podcast does what all these, you know, storytelling venues do, is they create the sense that there's so many people who are struggling with these same questions in so many different contexts. They were all really trying to find a sense of understanding by sharing something in an honest way.
Tova, I hope we can stay friends and keep in touch. We just think you're a marvelous writer and an incredible mom and a brave person. And we're so grateful that you trusted us to interview you today.
Imagine yourself walking into a forest. You can see the path and the trees. High above you, the air is crisp. You are walking towards your happy place. Allegedly, say it with me. Anything said here on this podcast about alleged cults, alleged MLM schemes, alleged douchebaggery, mindfuckery, criminality, spiritual fraud, or the like, is offered purely as commentary. because the views and opinions expressed on A Little Bit Culty do not necessarily reflect on official policy or position of the podcast. And any content provided by our guests, bloggers, sponsors, or authors are their opinion and are not intended to malign any religion, group, club, organization, business individual, anyone, or anything. So just let these words drift into your mind without needing to focus on any of them. You are great. You are capable. You deserve to be happy. Nobody's mad at you, unless you're actually a narcissistic, culty criminal. If that's you, cut that shit out. Don't be a fuckwad. But if that's not you, again, you are great. You are capable. You deserve to be happy. A Little Bit Culty loves you.
What'd you think, Sarah?
I just really want everyone to read this book. Like I said, I think that it's
all there.
It's just all there. And again, we will do other episodes diving into some of the more culty aspects of the religion. And since recording this, we found out that she's close to finishing her new novel. So keep an eye out for that.
And I'm sad to report, despite an hour or two of research, that I don't think the Jews word salad each other.
I like that. I like knowing that.
Yeah, but not in a way of like, I read something and don't get what the intent is behind it or don't get the essence of it. I don't read the quotes and stuff like that and feel confused. So Nippy has been trumped. I can't word salad it.
Trumped by the Jews.
I've been defeated.
Well, guess who has a lot of word salad? Teal Swan.
Oh, Teal Swan.
And if everything goes as planned, we'll be dropping that episode next week. And that's something that you guys have been asking for a long time. And we spoke with a reporter who covered Teal Swan and the Teal Tribe extensively in a podcast called The Gateway. So if you want to listen to that between now and next week, then you'll get a gold star.
You've got some podcasting to do.
You'll get a gold star and a stripe on your sash, and it'll be more interesting, I think. Because it's hard to do a deep dive in an hour, but he did an incredible deep dive into Teal Swan. So do your homework. Talk to you next week.
All right. Thanks, everyone.
Bye.
Toodles. Sinking down to the depths of the ocean. I'm hanging on to the weight of my love. If I let go of it all, I could leave. But I know. Let's keep the conversation going. We'll be back soon with more episodes of A Little Bit Culty with more experts and survivors. And sometimes experts who are survivors, as well as some familiar faces from The Vow from HBO. If you've got suggestions or questions on upcoming topics, find us on Instagram at A Little Bit Culty.
And for more background on what brought me here, my memoir, Scarred, The True Story of How I Escaped Nexium, the Cult That Bound My Life, is available on Amazon, Audible, and where most books are sold.
If you'd like to help us spread the word about A Little Bit Culty podcast, please give us a 5-star review and tell your friends to subscribe.
Seriously, take out their phone and tell them to press subscribe. It takes a second. We're also available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and every major listening app. And if you're listening on a smartphone, tap or swipe over the cover art of this podcast to find show notes and helpful resources.
You might also find some offers from our sponsors there. And when you support our sponsors, you help us keep this podcast going. Just don't be a little bit culty about it.
A Little Bit Culty is executive produced by me, your co-host, Sarah Edmondson, and Anthony Nippy Ames.
That's me.
Associate producer is Jess Tardy. Produced, edited, mixed, and mastered by Citizens of Sound. Our amazing theme song, Cultivated, is by John Bryant and co-written by Nigel Asselin. I'm Sarah Edmondson, and thanks for listening to A Little Bit Culty.